My name is Millie. I am an alcoholic. I was telling Sandy that you will know after I speak why I'm never asked to share the Sunday morning spiritual meeting. I still struggle with that a bit. But I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1960. And people didn't beat around the bush much in 1960. We were not into loving each other well. And we were not into hugging strangers, you know. So that I developed a way of coping with all of my problems being translated by alcoholic people. Now, I could read that book, and it all seemed kind of flowery to me, you know. But when people said, "Grow up, Millie," I understood that. I didn't know that this was a really spiritual program. And not being at all spiritual, they had to get down to the nitty-gritty with me. I was raised in a circus family and was a trapeze performer. And that takes a lot of training and a lot of discipline, and I fought it every inch of the way. It wasn't until I took an inventory in Alcoholics Anonymous that I discovered that's called defiance. and I am, I still struggle with that. Because you tell me to go north and I'll go south every damn time. I don't know what that is. But I just feel like surely there must be another way. You know? The first time I was ever drunk, my aunt and uncle had come to visit. And I was 10 years old. We were in an apartment in New York, I believe. And I was the gracious little hostess. And I served them the Muscatel wine. And that was the first time that it had been available to me to drink as much as I wanted. And I drank so much that I passed out. And my mother said to my father, she said, "My God, she's sick." And my father said, "No, she's drunk." And laughed. 20 years later, he was no longer laughing, let me tell you that. I was 6 years old, and we had come back from Europe and gotten off the ship, and my mother put me in kindergarten or first grade during the period they were in Madison Square Garden with the circus. And the teacher said the new girl in class, and she said, "Where did you come from?" And I told her I got off the big boat, and the captain let me wear his hat, and he wore my hat, and said, "Well, what does your father do?" I said, "He stands on his head on a trapeze." And she looked at me and proceeded to swat me over the knuckles with a ruler. And Clyde, you'll remember the rulers with a little bit of metal in them. Yeah, right over the knuckles. And I learned my lesson. You don't tell anybody anything that's true because you get swatted over the damn knuckles. So I began to make up stories. You know, what does your father do? He's a plumber. Yeah, and they believed it. You know, that they could believe. So that I became very aware that I did not live in that world. And I despised the other world. So I was between a rock and a hard place, you know. It was hard work. It was dirty. It was loud. I used to sneak off and go to the public library in the town. And you had to read because there wasn't anything else to do in a library. So I read, but I went to the library in all these little towns because it was quiet in the library. The band wasn't playing. The animals weren't screeching. There wasn't a lot of hubbub and brouhaha. So I got a pretty liberal education on my own. I never went to school after the seventh grade, and I always went in late and was taken out early, and the new girl in class, you know. I traveled, and I think I like to think that broadened me. I learned some valuable things out of my childhood. I learned a lot of things about other people because it's a great mixture of personalities and nationalities. That allowed me to be very tolerant of other people and other things and the way they lived. For that, I'm grateful. I'm also grateful to my parents because my genes. Had I not been as strong and as healthy as I was, I would have been dead. I married at age 22, had a daughter at age 23, and I married a professional musician. And I thought, well, that would be good for the simple reason he could not have me working. You know, wasn't anything I could do with him. I could get the hell out of that, racking my ass over that trapeze bar all every day and hurting all the time, you know, because I can remember that. I always hurt. My hands were sore. My back was sore. I got a rope burn or, you know, something was always wrong. I married a man who was a black Irishman. Did you ever meet one of those? The black hair and the blue eyes. God almighty, he was wonderful. And I fell head over heels in love. I always said that this was the kind of man I wanted. And I've come to realize anybody who was not in circus business would have been the kind of man I wanted. You know, I don't care what he did. He drank a lot. And I kept up with him pretty well. Finally, it got to the point where I was pretty disgusted with his drinking and decided that that was not the way I wanted to live my life. And the circus no longer looked so bad. And I had this little daughter, 10 months old. And I took her and I went the only place I knew to go, back with my parents and back into show business. And I worked hard and I got back in shape and continued that way. When I was 27, now I'm working and I'm, you know, doing this stuff, and all of a sudden my drinking begins to interfere a mite in this endeavor. I am having blackouts, and I'm coming to with my costume half on and half off, and I can't remember if I'd worked. I can't remember if I'd done the act, you know? And I would look at my shoes, and if they were dirty, I had worked. And if they, you know, and I took them off and took a drink. But if they were clean, if then my shoes were clean, I put my costume on, took a drink, and went out and did the act. Now, this gets a little trying on the nervous system after a while. You have people come up to you, you did a superb act today, and you try to remember how much you had to drink so you could drink that much again, so you do it good. When I was 27, my little girl was 5 years old, and I did not want to raise her in circus business. And I deluded myself for a lot of years that that was why I quit. The real reason I found out later when I got honest with myself, I was scared to death. Now, it never occurred to me that I might quit drinking and alleviate this problem. There was no information about alcoholism out there. So at that time, you never even talked about it, you know? It just wasn't the topic of conversation. And I was the kind of drunk, I did a lot of my social drinking in gas station toilets, you know, where you take the bottle around and go in the john and take a drink and come out. I did a lot of beach sitting, what I call. I would buy a jug and go down to the beach and put my feet in the surf and bewail the state of the universe. Drunker than hell, you know. But wasn't it terrible? And I come by that honestly. My father drank too much. I will not say he was an alcoholic because he never said it. And it's not my job to diagnose. But he was very depressed, very miserable. My daughter was out here one time and we were going through some old pictures. And we looked, and my mother was not a happy camper. And my daughter and I discovered that my mother very rarely smiled and never laughed. Never heard her laugh in my life. And very rarely smiled. So that I was raised in a very morbid atmosphere. I'm one of those that I believe I'd have been an alcoholic if I'd have been born in the wilds of Borneo with a bone through my nose. I'd have been fermenting something. I don't think that all of this past has anything to do with me developing the disease of alcoholism. But I do think it formed my personality. I do think that I always had that feeling of impending doom. I don't know what it is, but any minute now, it is going to be happening, and it is going to be terrible. I was not the kind of person who could join with other people in any sense of the word. I was always very conscious of what I was saying, very afraid I would say the wrong thing, and worst of all, that somebody would laugh at me. And this, coupled with the disease of alcoholism, made for a lovely drunk, you know. My daughter is visiting here from California, and she is the one who lived through my drinking. She was 12 years old when I got sober, and someone was mentioning, said, "I bet your mother was a pistol when she was drunk." And she turned to them and she says, "No, she was just pitiful." And I was a pitiful drunk. I really was. I've learned since getting sober, I'm a very social person. I just love this stuff. I like meeting new people. I have fun. But by God, that's not the way it was. When I was drinking, leave me the hell alone. Get out of my way. I am busy drinking. And I never thought barroom drinking was real drinking. You know, they put that little doily under the glass and they give you about that much. And, "Hell, Bells, take the cap off that sucker and let's go to it," you know. Mess around with them little beers and them little bitty drinks. And they wipe the bar. You know, take a lot of time doing that before they get that other drink out there. And I sure as hell didn't want to talk to anybody. So I was... Bars didn't hold any fascination to me. I came out to California, and we have a saying out there, it's, you know, fruits and nuts with a few flakes thrown in, the granola state. But it was warm, and at that time it was booming. There were jobs to be had, and I had never held a job other than circus business. So I went round to places, and I wound up at the telephone company. And I don't mean to be offensive to telephone workers, but, you know, if you look one ear and can't see out the other, they hire you. And they put me to work in the long-distance operator thing. And I found it interesting. But the only thing, they had me do 3 weeks of training, and they expected me to work from 8 to 5 without taking a drink. You know, they're real unreasonable about that. And that had never been necessary for me to do. You know? And I found that real difficult. But with my keen alcoholic mind, I took a split shift. I work 8 to 12, and then I work 4 to 8, and you get 4 hours of drinking time. You know? Figure that out real quick. You know, a train doesn't have to fall on me to figure this out. Naturally, it became progressively worse, harder for me to get in at 4 o'clock. I worked there a year and a half, and I couldn't stand it anymore. And I told my mother that it was because I was wearing that headset and that noise consistently in my ear was making me nervous. That's why I was drinking so much, you see. From there on, it's all a bit of a fog. The next 6 years are just a lot of things happened, a lot of marriages. I'm a marrying drunk, you know. I know some people aren't, but I'm a marrying drunk. I had one physical deformity. I have round heels. I laid down real easy. You know? And that really got me in about as much trouble as my drinking did, just between your eyes. And I remarried twice, and I'm running drunk. But I can always, you know, pull myself together and wash under my armpits and start over. Now, we're going to start it again. And I was always able to do that. My mother had heard of Alcoholics Anonymous somewhere. And I, to this day, I don't know. I never asked her, and I wish I had. But she said, you ought to call Alcoholics Anonymous. And hell, I'd have called Mahatma Gandhi to get off my back. Yeah, I'll call him. What the hell? You know? And I'm half gowed up. And they tell me, yeah, we have a meeting tonight. We're at 2502 Clarendon in Huntington Park. And they told me how to get there. By this time, the car's gone. You know, I'm pretty down and out. And I get on the streetcar, and then I have to take the bus. And I walk down, and it met in the ground. And that was the name of the group, The Hole in the Ground, which did not sound very Tony to me, you know. And I walk in there, and they got all these signs around. People seemed nice enough, would come up to me. And I'm looking at these signs. Action is the magic word. Yeah. What the hell is that? Let go and let God. And I don't understand that. And I'm getting ready to leave, and a couple said they'd take me home. And I'm getting ready to leave, and a little short guy, Mexican fella, with one leg, looked at me, and he said, shook my hand, and he said, Millie, just remember one thing. No matter what happens, I'm your friend. And I looked at him, and I thought, who the hell wants a one-legged Mexican for a friend? What in the hell is he talking about? He was to become one of my dearest friends. His wife taught me to make chili rellenos. And that's what I got from that first meeting. And I continued to go back, and a woman, there were two women in a group of 51. And this one woman, she bought me the book. And she had me sit down and read the doctor's opinion. And I said, by God, that's me. Yeah, that's what I am. Yeah, because I had a lot of periods where I would wonder, what the hell is the matter with me? You know? And I thought, well, you know, all these meetings and all this God stuff. I interpreted that, you know, God stuff they talked about as having to hit the sawdust trail and, you know, get a tambourine or something. I thought, I'm not going to go that route. And now that I know what's the matter with me, I'll take care of it. Now, you know how well that worked, don't you? Yeah. When I was laying dead drunk, I went on a drunk to end all drunks. I was drunk around the clock. I could not navigate. I could no longer sober up. And I was drinking around the clock. And the woman I had met in AA kind of kept track of me. And she'd call my parents and talk to them. How's our girl? Well, not very well, you know. So she showed up on the doorstep of my apartment, this garage apartment, and said, Millie, step out here. And I stepped outside, and there were two of the biggest damn policemen I ever saw in my life. And they said, you are drunk on private property. Come with us. And I turned to my sponsor, and I said, should I go with him? She said, I would suggest that you do. She had gotten next to a judge that she'd done a lot of work with. And at 9 o'clock the next morning, this is in the middle of the afternoon, 9 o'clock the next morning, I haven't had a drink in about 6 hours. And, man, I am really a sick cookie. I am really hurting. And we drive down to Los Angeles. And periodically, the sheriff would let me open the door and try to throw up, but it's dry heaves, and you know, we don't have to go into that, do we, boys and girls? And I'm shaking. And we get up at the jail and get off the elevator, and the deputy sheriff calls, nurse. Nurse comes toddling down there, and she looks at me and she said, are you going to have DTs? I said, no, thank you. Well, and the last thing I remember at that time was I was thrown over this hospital bed and shot in the can with something, and I woke up 3 days later. I was strapped down, so I assume I had convulsions or DTs or something, you know. They don't strap you down if you're just laying there, usually. My sponsor had taken this extreme measure because at that time, we're talking about 1960, there were no treatment centers. There was a state nut house where they were shooting electricity through you, you know, shock treatment. And my sponsor didn't think highly of that. There were not the major tranquilizers out, you know, that they could give you to maintain anything. So that this seemed the best shock therapy she could think of. I'm sure that she talked to my mother because my mother came up to see me in jail. And I said, now, Mother, I'm all right. Don't worry. And they're treating me well, and I'm all right. She says, I know it. You're right where you belong. I haven't had a drink since. You know? That judge had said 10 days in the county jail. And after the 3 days, I had a week. And I had all I wanted. I can remember sitting on that cot in that jail cell and thinking, if I ever get out of here, I am going to go back to AA and I will do anything they tell me to do. And if that doesn't work, I'll cut my throat. I was through drinking. That was a given. I had really taken that second step while I was drinking. I had come to believe that you people had an answer. And everybody you talk to, they'd say, I'm sober by the grace of God. And I'd say, chee, 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 isn't that lovely? Isn't that wonderful for you? Yeah. Congratulations, you and God both. And my sponsor was the kind of woman, well, I went to a what you call now a halfway house. It was Friendly House in Los Angeles, run by a woman named Beatrice. And they made a movie about it later. Carol Burnett starred in it, starred Beatrice. And a bunch of women coming in. There were about 10 of us in the house. There were 4 of us in this one bedroom. And I'm looking around. And one gal is an orphan, raised in an orphanage up in Minnesota somewhere. There was another gal from a big Italian Catholic family. There was another gal, little housewife. And here was the old showgirl laying in the other bed. And I thought that really didn't make any difference because we were all there for one reason. We drank a little bit too much. Alcohol had brought us all together in that one room. And I don't know how to tell you the way that that affected me. I felt connected somehow with the people that I came in contact with. I stayed there for 6 weeks, and we had to go to a meeting, in 2 in-house meetings, and women picked us up and took us to other meetings, and I heard a woman speak. I've never talked to her, not to this day, but her name was Alma, and she said that she was thrown off a boxcar coming west to pick fruit in the orchards, and she had a man's t-shirt and a pair of jeans on tied with a rope and barefoot. And they had thrown her off this boxcar in this station, and a man picked her up from AA and took her home, and his wife cleaned her up. And that was 10 years prior to the time she was speaking. And she said, and today I was elected as the Democratic delegate to the National Convention. And that impressed me. You can't get there from here, you know? I thought, but I believed her. But I believed her. And I've never seen her before nor since, but she touched my life. And I remember her name. I often think in those early days of how troubled I was, how what a struggle. The spirituality was my biggest barrier. I just could not figure that out at all. And I, in working with people, I find some who are struggle with that, and I find others who say, yes, I understand. I think, gee, that's nice. You know, I'll bet you do. You know, one of those things. But they do. They do. They just understand. You know. And I didn't understand. I'm very grateful for the way the big book is written, because like in the 12 steps, when it at the end of the 12 steps and says the ABCs and how it works, and it says God could and would if he were sought, you know, doesn't say you got to find him. And I latched on to that. Yes, I will open my mind enough to seek it, whatever it is. So I began a real in-depth process of letting go and taking people for their word and believing in people. And the men around AA were wonderful. They were so protective of us women. And they treated us like ladies, even when we had mouths like sewer rats. My sponsor told me, she said, we don't talk like that in AA. I beg your pardon, you know. I learned all I know about living in society from living in AA. I went to a meeting one time, and I'd been working out in the garden, and I just threw a bandana around my head and had a pair of shorts and a T-shirt on or something, and bopped into the meeting, and my sponsor came to me and scolded me. She said, "You have a message for people, and I don't want to see you coming to a meeting dressed like that. Would that be attractive if a new woman walked in? Would she want what you have?" And she said, "Be very careful how you act. You may be the only copy of the big book someone ever sees." And I began to be very careful of the way I acted, both in and out of AA. Venta was the kind of person, that was my sponsor, she was the kind of person that if she told you something, you could take it to the bank. The most honest human being I have ever met. No fiddle-faddle, you know. Played no games, just right from here to you. And I so admired her. There was a fellow in AA, and he announced that he was going to get married. We stand around the hall, and he pulled out a picture of her, and Velda says, "Well, that's wonderful. You shouldn't be alone, you know." She says, "I believe that men and women were made to be married, and I think that's good that you've found somebody." And he gave her the picture, and he said, "Well, she's no Marilyn Monroe." And Velda says, "Well, hell, you're no Rock Hudson either." another time, the guy was talking, and he was telling some long, convoluted story, and Velda looked him right now, and she said, "I do not believe you." And he said, "Are you calling me a liar?" She said, "I don't know. I don't know if you're a liar or not. I'm just telling you that I do not believe you." We were down, and I'm slowly but surely, the fog is clearing. And I am reaching a point where I'm thinking about this third step. And I'm maybe 6 months sober. And there was an old fellow in our group who was called Sparky. He'd been sober about 8, 9 years. And wore a painter's hat off to the side. And smoked a big cigar. And he told his story. He said, "I lived on Skid Row for 7 years. Didn't have a bath in 7 years. Shaved with lava soap. Came to AA with a 50-cent suit with $50 worth of chili on it." By God. And I was not attracted to him. You know, he was not an attractive man. However, I was working by this time, and I was driving home from work, and I drove by his house, and there's Sparky out in the yard. There's a tree, and he's out planting petunias out around the tree. And I thought, Skid Row for 7 years and planting petunias? He must have found something to change him, you know. I'll ask him the next time how he worked that third step. And I went to him, and I did. I pulled him off to the side, and I said, "Sparky," I said, "what the hell does that third step mean to you?" And he said, just as quick as that, he says, "It means keep your goddamn nose out of other people's business." I said, "Finally, someone who I can understand. At last, somebody who is at my level." But that was a very profound statement. I use it today. Is that really any of my business? And 99 times out of 100, it's none of my business. I have begun to play what I call, if it's my business, I'm there. If it's not my business, I leave. I have reached a point, I believe, where I feel pretty comfortable with my life. You've heard other speakers, the experiences they go through. Life is not always peachy keen. Gee, ain't it wonderful to be sober? I'm so good and happy I got here. And there are times, and the book tells me, there are times when you just put one foot in front of the other. I was sober about a little over a year, and I met a man through a woman friend of mine in AA, and her non-alcoholic husband worked with this man and suggested that I meet him, and said he was really a wonderful man, and he told him that I want you to meet a lady who you'd be proud to take anywhere. And I met him, and we had dinner together, and he called me, and pretty soon we're dating. And now I didn't know how to date. You don't have relationships, you take hostages. So this was all very foreign to me. However, I was secretary of a Tuesday night group and attended a Friday night group. And I told him, I said, I can't see you on Tuesday and Friday night. He told me later he thought I was dating someone else on those nights. And he would take me to dinner. He didn't know I was alcoholic. No reason for him to know. And we would sit up at the bar before you got a seat, you know. And I would drink ginger ale. And finally, about the third or fourth time, he said to me, he says, you don't drink, do you? And I said, does that bother you? He said, no, I think it's ladylike. Oh, boy, are you in for a rude awakening? Yeah. Finally, there was a potluck dinner, and I'm fixing a pot of beans or something, and I took Andy along. I said, you come with me. I want you to meet my friends. And right as we got to the front door, I said, these are people who are members of Alcoholics Anonymous and their spouses. And I walked through the door real quick. And he followed me. I bet he thought, boy, this ought to be interesting. You know? And we had fun. We ate. We played games. You know, like any AA gathering. It was just wonderful. And pretty soon I look around and I can't find Andy. Where is he? And he's hard to miss. You know, he's 6'5", 200 pounds. You don't lose a guy like that real easy. You just look over everybody's head and there he is. And I see him sitting over in the corner of the room. And on the other corner of the room, they had brought a wet drunk in. It was after the meeting. And they were sitting talking to him. They knew Red was having this get-together, so they brought him over there. And they're sitting there talking to him. And Andy's, I said, do you want to go? And he says, shh, shh. He's listening to this conversation going on. So finally, when we did leave, we're driving home, and he says, you know, those two guys said that we're figuring out a way where one of them could take him home and spend the night with him if the other fellow would call his wife. And they were making arrangements to help this fellow. He said, would they really do that? I said, they certainly would. He said, by God, that's Christian. And that was his interpretation of that. We did get married, and I went to my sponsor. I told her before we got married, I said, Velta, you know me better than anybody else in the world. I said, do you think I am ready to be a wife? And she said, well, Millie, can you tell me if you get married and everything's going along just great, for the first 6 months you're happy as a clam, and at the end of 6 months he comes in and just hits you on the kisser and knocks you down, and can you get up and stay sober? And I thought about it for a minute, and I thought, yes, I believe I can. She said, then marry the son of a bitch. What do you got to lose? So I did, and began the adventure of a lifetime. I don't know how many alcoholics who are married to non-alcoholic social drinkers. He would go out, my daughter was talking about this at dinner and lunch. He would go out mow lawn, go down, buy a six-pack of beer, drink one, and make the goddamnedest fuss over that one beer. Boy, is this good. Man, it's really fine. Yeah, I really wanted that. And then 3 or 4 weeks later, he'd say, I'd really like a beer. Do we have any in the refrigerator? I'd say, yes, five. I wasn't going to drink it, but by God, I kept track of it, you know. Yes, sir. We went over to some friend's house to play cards. And in the evening, and they serve some mixed drinks, and they're sitting there drinking them, and I'm drinking my ginger ale. And about 10 o'clock at night, the hostess gets up and comes back in with a pot of coffee and a big coconut cake and sits it down on the table. And the husband says, "Oh, Boots, you made that lovely coconut cake I like so much." Took about a half a drink and set it up on the fireplace and proceeded to eat coconut cake and drink coffee. Now, I don't know about you, but 11 o'clock at night and 3 or 4 drinks, I don't want no damn coconut cake. That is not the thrill of a lifetime. I began to go to a women's meeting because I figured that with this guy I had a good thing going. Let's not loss it up, you know. And I began going to a women's meeting, and we formed a social circle out of that, women with non-alcoholic husbands, and that was a great part of our social life. And I remember one time Jack and Helen Hughes were over, and Jack was talking about his drinking and telling some stories, and my husband turned to Helen and he says, "How did you put up with that?" And Helen said, "I never met anybody that was sober that I liked as well as I liked Jack drunk." So we were. I had a good job. I was in the hospital, admitting clerk, and boy, I really liked it. We're going along really well, and I'm on the rhythm method. How many of you ever tried that? I missed a beat somewhere. My son had a daughter from a previous marriage who was 19 when we got married, and up I pop. The rabbit dies, you know. And I'm terribly upset. I really don't believe this is the way to go. And out of that was a little girl who really gave me a new lease on life. She's here this evening, too. And we really, I began to feel like a mother. I'd reestablished something with my daughter, but I missed so much. I really never thought that I would regain the mother and daughter relationship. I thought that was too much to ask, because my mother would send her off with me with a dime tied in the end of a handkerchief to reach the telephone, which she did on several occasions, have to call her grandmother, being with me. When I got caught in the Murphy bed and could not get down, she found it necessary to go down the hall and get some guy to lift her up to the telephone and get the Murphy bed down. And you know, I was not the mother figure, really. The roles were kind of reversed. And I remember taking her to a drive-in, and we're in there, and I've got my bottle of wine, and I'm doing the right thing, you understand? I'm taking my daughter to the movies. By the time the movie's over, I'm passed out. She wakes me up, and I'm trying to get out of there, and I run into the front of the thing, and I back up, and I run into the back, and I proceed to pass out. And she has to take the dime out of her handkerchief and call her grandmother to come get them. So that I really felt that anything that my daughter wanted to give me was gravy. Luckily, she chose to forgive me. And I think we have a good relationship today. But this little girl came along, and my dear, this was amazing. I was awake all the time. She was grown up. I just never knew what went on during that time. We were married for 23 years, and he passed away. And within a period of 2 years, this baby girl got married, moved halfway across the country. A boy we adopted, a little younger than our daughter, had gone away to college, and here I sit. And I'm thinking, my God, now what do I do? Who pushed me out here, you know? What am I going to do? I couldn't stop crying. I just could not quit crying. And I knew that this wasn't good for me, and I went to my regular Tuesday night meeting, and I talked about it, and a woman was very helpful. She'd lost her husband, too, and she and I were sober about the same length of time, and we kind of worked through a lot of that stuff together. But I went down to Walmart and just to wait for a blue light special or something, anything, you know, do to get your mind off this terrible thing. I go in the ladies' room, and there's a paper bag with an empty pint bottle of whiskey in it. And I remember thinking, my God, where are you? Do I have a message for you? In AA, then they were talking about treatment centers. There was not a lot of talk about treatment centers, you know, at that time. So I said, what the hell is a treatment center? And they said, well, it's where the drunk go. I said, well, where is it? It's in the hospital. Well, I better go up there. That's where the drunks are. And I began doing that, and I did a 12x12 study and a big book study. And the director of this specific treatment center and I became friendly and eventually offered me a job as a counselor, and I was counseling, which was a fascinating experience because I had never believed that there were so many people. You know, they're coming into AA now in bunches. They used to kind of straggle in, you know, one or two at a time, you know, when the whole group could envelop them and say, there's the new guy. What does he need? My sponsor would take me all over the country. She would say, there's a woman over in Santa Monica. Let's go. By God, we'd go to Santa Monica to meet that woman. And I was reading some figures that between 1960 and now, we're almost a third of the fellowship women are. And when I came in, we weren't even one-tenth. And I really believe that the stigma is off is the reason the women are coming out of the closet. All I know, I have learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, being able to share with people and have them share with me has been the experience of a lifetime. For a lot of years, I did the mother and wife thing, and I went to one meeting a week, and I had good friends in AA that we socialized with, and I had people who would bring a new gal over to talk to me, so that I got a lot of support from the AA group, the women's group. And there's a girlfriend out in California that she and I sobered up together. And I'm sitting in a meeting in Neosho, Missouri, and she pipes up, she says, that's Millie. And I said, yeah, who are you? She said, I'm Ruth S. from Downey. And I said, oh my God, you're the woman that ran away with my husband. And a pall fell over that hall, and oh boy, now let's watch the two old broads go to it. And the way that happened is my husband's brother had died, and he was coming back to Missouri to the funeral, and he asked Ruth if she wanted to go along, and she did. So they came back here to Missouri. She was from Neosho. I took care of Leo. I washed, ironed, and cooked him stuff. So that was how that happened. She's the one that says 90% of what you hear in AA is bullshit. She says, but the other 10% are gems. The other 10% are real gems. My sponsor asked me, what do you want out of life? I was a whiner. You know, I whined a lot. what do you want out of life? And I said, I want to be loved. Isn't that cute? And she said to me, then your job is to become lovable. Because right now you're not very goddamn lovable, honey. There was a gal in AA who used to embroider in the meeting. And I didn't think she should be doing that. And I filed a complaint with my sponsor. I said, how dare she sit there and and come Christmas time, was a little box with three little tea towels in it and a little card that said, just to Millie, just because I like you. From that time on, I mean, I don't care what you do, you know. If you weave a rug or take a leap over in the corner, don't hear me, not the hound of me. There was a gal around AA, and she was overweight, and we were standing around the group, and a group of us talking, and I made some remark, and she made a remark, and they all laughed. And you understand, of course, they were laughing at me. And I heard by the grapevine she didn't show up for meetings. She had what we now know as an eating disorder. She had gotten so heavy. Her husband had left her. And she did show up at the meeting, and I walked up to her very nicely. And I said, hello, Kathy. You've gained some weight. How's Russ? And that may give you a picture of my personality. I would just love to put the knife in and turn it. And they didn't even know they'd been had. It was a wonderful part about it. I have become much more direct now. If I have something to say, I say it, you know. I try not to be cruel. But I am honest. How are we for time? Pretty good. I heard a woman say something. She said, I'm not what I should be. I'm probably not what I could be. But at least I ain't what I was. And I want to thank you.